I skipped. Akela, you were double, you were behind over. Partly because those are very difficult concepts. But it was pointed out to me by a couple of people that was missing. So maybe I'll say a little bit about those ideas. I think you have to rely on literature from the parts of the Torah that aren't usually studied at this stage. These are three characteristics: Godol, Gibor, and Nora. Godol is usually translated as great. That's because the translator is embarrassed about the real meaning. The real meaning of Godol is big. But saying the guy is big just doesn't sound right somehow. Especially if you ask, how big? Right. And the size, you know, for any size you give, so there could always be a bigger size. So that doesn't sound right at all. Even if it's a very big size. Just add a number and you get a bigger size. Now, traditionally, in this deeper literature, the word gadol is associated with the attribute of chesed, loving kindness. The question is, why would that be? What's one thing have to do with the other? And here's the idea. If big means a size, then as we said, whatever size you pick, it'll be a bigger size. Here's an interesting game you can play with, or have younger kids play. It's a contest. Two people, each person picks a number. The person who picks the bigger number wins. So you don't see the other person's number until they both pick your numbers. What do you do now? How can I even figure out a number that's bigger than his number? So one way you do it is, the number you pick is your number plus one. That's what you write on your paper. You know, your number plus one. Anyway, suppose in thinking, instead of thinking of a size, a very large size, we thought of something that was constantly growing. Constantly, endlessly growing. Then this thing eventually, well, they say it right, for any size you pick, eventually this thing will surpass it. This would be big in a new sense, in a qualitatively different sense. This is big in a sense that it's superior to any size you want to try, any size you pick. Because this thing will outstrip any size you like. Now chesed, the concept of chesed, is the concept of something that gives. The symbol of chesed, in Jewish terms, is a well, a spring. A spring that gives water. It just gives and gives and gives and gives. So if you think of God as a source of good, which is what chesed means, loving kindness, if you think of a source of good, an endlessly giving source of good, then he's big in an absolute sense. In a way that transcends any particular size you would want to put on it. So maybe the word big isn't so bad after all. But big understood in this absolute sense, outstripping any given size. So if you understand Godol as this concept of big, this absolute concept of big, then it's associated with chesed, with loving kindness, in the sense that loving kindness is a source of giving good, a source that never runs out. At any rate, that's the quality of God that is expressed by the word gadol. And indeed, there's one place in the Torah where Moses pleads with God for mercy, and he uses this attribute. So, it seems like it does have association with the appropriate application. So that's gadol, more or less.
That means that at any given time, there's a fixed amount of chesed that Hashem is being given by Hashem. Because it is, you can put a number on it, you can say that it keeps coming, but at the specific time, there's a fixed amount of chesed being given by Hashem.
So I think that's correct.
Okay.
I think that's correct. There's a finite number of souls that have been created in the world. They've lived for a finite amount of time. They've experienced a finite number of things. Only, it's eternal. Since it's eternal, so it will surpass any finite amount. Yeah.
Does that mean that God is changing? Because every day he's like adding, it gets to getting bigger.
I'll give you a standard analogy, and maybe it'll be enough for now. I don't know how deep I want to push this. The light that's produced by the sun contains more or less the full spectrum of colors, or what are officially called hues. Now, if one day you put up blue panes of glass in your window frames, and the next day you put up red panes of glass in your window frames, and the next day you put up yellow frames of glass in your window frames, you will experience different colors of light each day. That doesn't mean the light is different. That means that what you were able to interact with was different. So it doesn't have to mean that he's changing. It means that the conditions under which his output is experienced, is received, are changing, and his output is sensitive to the conditions under which it's received. Doesn't have to mean that he's changing, or even that his output is changing. Okay, that's Gogol, more or less. Now, Gibor. Gibor is translated as mighty. As a translation, that's not too bad. The trouble is that when you're talking about the creator of the universe, it's a little pale. You remember the analogy we're working with now for several days. Suppose you were described as more powerful than the thing that's in your dream. Would you take that as a great compliment? Would you take that as a recognition of your awesome power? That you have more power than the thing that's in your dream? So listen, you know, it can really not be competition. Because I just dream them, you know. They're there because I think them. If I don't think them, they're not there. There's no point in setting up that kind of competition. Now, the Mishnah says, Ezu Gibor, Kovesh's Yisro. Who is powerful? One who conquers his own spirit. Well, I think there's a step in the right direction. I'm in competition with myself, so to speak. One part of me is in competition with another part of me. So it's not a question of measuring my power against something external, especially if it's a question of me and my dream figures, where it's ridiculous to set up a competition. But now, between me and me, could be quite a reasonable competition. The problem now will be, can we apply that concept to God? An internal struggle? One part of God that is against another part of God? But on the other hand, I'm just showing you how you work on these problems. On the other hand, the word is the same word. It's the word in the same language. Could the Mishnah have given a meaning to the word which applies only to human beings and doesn't apply to God? The Mishnah knew that the Tanakh uses this word for God. So, now I think that you can take the Mishnah and apply it across the board. Yes, real Gevurah, real power means one internal part conquering another internal part. How does that apply to God? Because God, in the picture, as we spoke about two days ago, in the picture that he gives us of how he operates, there are different principles. And those principles, by their definitions, can come into conflict. The two principal rules, the two principal concepts, which can come into conflict are chesed, loving kindness, and then strict justice, strict accountability, being given what you've earned, and nothing more. In their bare definitions, they are strictly contradictory. You cannot show loving kindness when you pay a person according to what he has earned, strictly according to the contract. That's not love and that's not kindness. On the contrary, you owe it to him. If you don't pay him, he can take you to court and force you to pay it. You're just satisfying your responsibilities when you pay him. You're fulfilling your obligations. That's not love and that's not kindness. Love and kindness means you have to go beyond what you owe. Beyond what you're responsible to do or what you're obligated to do. But then it's not what he's earned. It's not what he's due. It's not what justice requires that I give him. Now, in particular interactions, the two principles can demand different results. There can be a struggle between the two principles by which God runs the world. Now, those of you who have been with me for a while know that one of them is superior to the other. Chesed is really the source of all. So if there were a flat-out conflict between loving kindness on the one hand and justice on the other, loving kindness always wins. Loving kindness always wins. But justice got there because it's an expression of loving kindness also. It didn't come in from the outside. It's not a competing principle. That would mean you have two gods, not one. So in a particular case, the loving kindness expressed in justice could demand what outcome? And the loving kindness that transcends justice could demand a different outcome. And each one is rooted in the original principle of loving kindness, and therefore you can have a conflict. And it may be that, well, I should say, maybe, in such a case, in order for one principle to operate, the other principle has to be held back. And in particular, since justice is the means, and loving kindness is the ultimate goal. In our world, most often, it's going to be justice holding back the broader loving kindness because we are investing in a long-term result. Now it comes out pretty literal. Gevura. Gevura, might, is associated with the expression of justice. Why would might be associated with justice? What do I have in common? Well, to apply justice means holding back pure loving kindness. That's got to be held back. You're holding back the original principle in its pure form for the sake of applying the original principle in its complicated form, the form in which it expresses itself in as justice. It becomes now pretty literal. That may be part of why this literature that I'm alluding to calls the principle of justice by the word dvura, might. Because any application of justice requires holding back something. And then indeed, it's an internal struggle, so to speak, not struggle, but there's the reconciliation. The decision which one to apply in a particular case, and when you apply one, the other one is not applied. So the idea of gvura, as described in a person, that one part of him holds back the other part, can be applied to God, and can be applied specifically in the case where justice is put into action. And that's gvura. Now, I hope you're with me, sort of. This is very deep stuff, and I'm skimming off the top. Trying to avoid the really deep stuff, but I'm just said somebody asked you about it, so I'm just going through a little bit. Okay, all that was child's play. Now comes Nora. About this, I have very little to say. Nora means awesome. Nora is based on Yira. Yira is awe. Let's think about awe for a minute. What does it mean to say, wow, that's awesome? As we say in pidgin English nowadays. No. That's an awesome ice cream soda.
awesome means that the thing is objectively great. Awe is based on a judgment, an objective judgment, that the thing is great, and awe is my reaction to its greatness. I feel how great it is, and I feel how small I am, and my accomplishments are in comparison. I say it's objective, that means that someone's awe can be misplaced and criticized. Krishna says, that's awesome. He owes a reason to back it up. And he can be criticized. Imagine a person who's not familiar with athletics, Olympic style athletics. And he's watching somebody warming up, and the guy does a double somersault, you know, in the air. Wow, he says, that's awesome. He says, no, listen. He's only warming up, you know. In the competition, they do five. He's just doing two because he's taking it easy today, you know. That's not awesome. What are you talking about? That's common. I mean, even amateurs can do that. You want to see something awesome? Watch the competition. Then you see something awesome. Awesome is wrong there. It's wrong. Because that isn't awesome. It's common. You couldn't feel awe for something that you and half of your friends can do. That would not excite awe. Because it's common. So the first element in awe is the sense of greatness, greatness as an objective quality of the item. People who think that all these judgments are subjective and only a matter of taste have to think again. Far less dependent upon your individual subjective taste than you think. Shakespeare is awesomely great, period. The fact that you don't enjoy Shakespeare has nothing to do with his greatness. When you say he's great, you're not expressing your subjective reaction or response. You're talking about the quality of his writing. Okay, so now we say that God has this quality of awesomeness. The very first element is, he's so overwhelmingly great, I feel like nothing. I feel vanishing when I think of him and I think of myself, and I recognize the gap. That's one of them. Another element, which I really can't explain adequately, is that Nora. Awesome is in some way a result of taking the first two together. Loving kindness and justice taken together. Now here, it isn't as if I haven't tried to figure this out, but it's not even clear to me whether taken together means they sort of work together hand in hand, what one would call a mechanical combination, or whether there's an amalgam of the two of them creating something else, a kind of chemical combination. 150 years ago, 200 years ago, you would never have guessed that water is made of two gases, one of which you have to breathe to stay alive. What's water got to do with gases? Happens to be made of hydrogen and oxygen, which they proved with electrolysis, but before that, no one had a clue that that was made of. So, I'm inclined to think that the combination of chesed and gvura that you have in Nora, in awesomeness, is at least in part the idea of creating a new thing out of the two of them. Especially when I think of they're not synonyms, but the other words that are used for this quality, like Tiferes and like Emes, there's something very rich, deep, fundamental, and subtle going on there, and I can't really do it justice. I really can't do it justice. I'll just say one more thing, which is important for itself, and then I'm going to let go. One of the words that's associated with this quality is Emes. Now, trusting your dictionary, as you shouldn't, but you do, you look up emes and it says truth. That's a mistake. Emes does not mean truth.
Certainly not in the Tanakh, in the Bible. Maybe later the rabbis borrowed it to use in other contexts, more or less as true, but that's not its classical meaning. For one thing, in the Tanakh, emes is usually a quality of action. It's a quality of action. Emes is something you do. Now, true doesn't apply to actions. You don't have true actions and false actions. It's just not used that way. Things that are true are propositions, beliefs, theories, ideas, assertions, sentences, statements, not actions. The phrase, emes she, it is true that, is never found in the Tanakh, not even once. Things are called emes. God is called emes. Twice the Tanakh talks about a shalom, which is emes. In the Talmud, Moreh Shabbos makes two remarks about the word emes. One remark is, as against Sheker, that if you look at the individual letters of emes, the Aleph has 2 points, the Mem has a platform, and the Sof has 2 points. Each letter has a foundation on which to stand. Sheker, all the letters come to a point. The Shin comes to a point, the Kuf has a single line, the Resh comes to a point, so they're ready to fall over. Also, Emes is composed of the first, middle, and last letters of the Aleph base. Sheker, all the letters are together. Kuf, Resh, Shin are letters that are right together in the Aleph base. Okay, time for a footnote. Emes is the first, middle, and last letters of the Aleph base. How many letters are there in the Aleph base?
28.
Good guess, but not quite correct. Right. What's the answer, first of all? How many letters are there? 22, right?
Yeah,
so 22, it's an even number. Even number doesn't have a middle letter. Now you'll learn how careful the Talmud is.
29?
No.
That's way too much.
There are 22 letters, sort of. But if you would add in the otiyot, sofiyot, you know what those are?
The final letters.
How many extra final letters are there?
Five.
Yeah.
27.
Five. And if you put them in order, then the mem, the regular mem, not the shlus mem, as you learn from the Seder, but you know, not the final mem, but the regular mem, is 14 out of 27. So it's exactly in the middle. Exactly. Just what Chazal said it was. So MS has the first, middle, and last letter of the Aleph base. Kuf, Resh, Shin are sitting together, also ready to fall over. Now, here's the wrong way to understand it. The truth is solid. The truth stands. The truth will last forever. So you see, emes is a strong word. Falsehood, lies, fall over. They're not going to stand forever. That's why the word for lies is ready to fall over. That's a mistake. Because that would mean that the Talmud is commenting on a quality of truth and a quality of falsehood. That's not the right understanding. The right understanding is that the Talmud is defining MS and defining Sheker. It's not telling me a characteristic they have. It's telling me what they are. All of this was inspired to me by an essay of Festus, a little three-page essay, which I have to read 10 times to understand. Emes means roughly that which is eternal, that which is real. Sheker means that which is an illusion, that which is ephemeral, will pass away, because it has no reality. That's what Emes and Sheker mean. This is why, those of you who have studied Chumash with me, and you know that it is appropriate to lie from time to time,
Nevertheless, sheker is never appropriate. Never. Sheker is never appropriate. It's appropriate to lie, but sheker is never appropriate. If that sounds funny to you, it's because you're still hypnotized by the dictionary. Sheker doesn't mean lies. Sheker means that which is not real. And that's why in the Talmud, the phrase which endorses lying from time to time is l'shanos mipnei hashalom. Not l'shaker mipnei hashalom. Never. Midrash Sheker Tirchak has no exception. Stay far away from sheker. There are no rights to have any connection with sheker. Everything has to be emes. And this is what set me off in Rav Dessler. Dessler says that those lies that the Torah endorses for the sake of peace, those lies are emes. That's what he said. And I thought to myself, why are you beating around the bush? Why don't you call a spade a spade? Why don't you just say that in this case you're allowed to do sheker? For years I was too lazy to take out the concordance and check the words in the Tanakh, and I couldn't understand what Rav Dessler was talking about. Finally, I overcame my laziness and took out the concordance, and I discovered the things that I just told you. Rav Dessler is 100% right. And not that he needs my endorsement, but it took me years to find out he's 100% right. And that when you lie for the sake of peace, you are engaging in emes, not in sheker. Because there, what's ultimately real, what's ultimately going to stand, is that lie. That's how that lie can be written in the Torah. The Torah is Torah of emes. And that lie, in that case, is emes. At any rate, that being the case, if emes is another word for this quality, and by the way, one of the things that should have had more influence on me earlier, when my oldest son was 17, he said to me, Abba, something's got to be wrong here, because Jacob's characteristic, his essence, the quality that he describes is emes. Now, if emes just means telling the truth, are you going to tell me his whole essence, his whole relationship with God, all he built in the world is never to tell lies? That's it? No, that's the whole of his religious accomplishment. It's too thin. It's just too thin. There's not enough to it. 100% right. 100% right. So this quality of Nora is a quality which has to be a lot of loose ends. I don't really understand. But at least I'm giving you something to go on for. Go to Hebrew about Nora. These three characteristics, which are described of God, are the three characteristics that are of the patriarchs in order: Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And that's why it's probably put next to the reference to God, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob.
Why are each one of them referred to like that?
Each one of the patriarchs.
I mean, I understand why Noah is referred to. You said Yitzchak is Noah, so it's not Noah.
No, Yaakov.
Yaakov is Noah. So why is Avram Gadol?
Because Gadol is Chesed, right? Loving kindness.
Oh, okay, but some right. So why is Gibor Yitzchak?
Why is Gibor Yitzchak?
But he did nothing. He didn't really do that much. I mean, he did stuff, but I mean, he didn't seem like such a Gibor.
Well, let's see. I seem to recall one incident in Isaac's life where he had to be willing to die because his father told him that God wanted it. Well, I think talking about Gibor as overcoming yourself... If you're overcoming your own natural drive to live, and if you motivate it with the thought that if my principle is strict justice, do I, in strict justice, deserve to live? Have I earned the right to live? Can I make a claim against God, you owe me life? Probably not. So applying the principle of strict justice to himself and applying the principle of Gibor, meaning to conquer your own desires, I think it works out pretty well, actually.
Auburn did the same thing also. He jumped into as the Midrash.
Yes, that's the Midrash. Well, but here's something very important. The Midrashic stories are true, but there's a reason why they're in the Midrash and not in the Torah. Because they don't express the same essence. They don't express the same essence. They have the same role in the character of the person. Now, this is part of a much longer shiur that I have on these subjects, which I'm not going to go through the rest of now. Okay, but I gave you something. All right? Okay. Now we're up to Mezi Goel Lidnei B'nehem Laman Shemo B'Ahava. He brings a redeemer to their children's children, their being the patriarchs, for the sake of his name and love. There is some discussion here. Does this mean the Messiah? Is Goel here, redeemer, sort of with a capital R? Well, we probably wouldn't make it with a capital R. Leave that to some other words. Is it the redeemer? Goel in Hebrew doesn't have to mean the, it can mean a. Is this an ongoing activity that God brings people who save us from various problems from time to time? Or is this a unique reference to the coming of the Messiah? Now, when we get to the middle section of the Shemoneh Esrei, there are 19 blessings. The first 6 blessings are personal, communal, and limited to local circumstances. The last 7 are national. In the last 7, you talk about the rebuilding of Jerusalem and the gathering of the exiles. You talk about the reestablishment of the temple and the Messiah. The first 6 you talk about wisdom and help in doing tshuva and forgiveness and health and parnasa, livelihood, and geula, salvation. That's 1 of the 6. So there, salvation clearly means local salvation from local problems. There is definitely not talking about the Messiah. That comes later on. And the closing of that bracha is Goel Yisrael, the Redeemer of Israel. So the word Goel does not have to be associated with the Messiah. Now, let's put in the fact that in this phrase that we're dealing with in the first blessing, the verb is in the present tense. He brings a redeemer. Not brought or will bring, but brings. See, you have to split. If you say that it's talking about the Messiah, then we'll have to say something like what I said to him at the beginning. He's bringing and we're not getting. Well, how does that work? The answer is, we're putting up our own filter. He's bringing. The power of the Messiah is there. The influence, the energy is there. If it's not happening, it's because we're not putting ourselves in a position where we can receive it. That's one way out. The other way out is to say that it's talking about time after time, place after place, local redemptions from troubles, which we get all the time. At any rate, that's what he's doing. He's bringing a redeemer. Now for whom? For their children's children. For the descendants of Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. This is what I told you yesterday. When it says that God remembers the kindnesses of the patriarchs, what? Oh, hold on. Time for a short quiz. What did we say Zocher means? Not remember. That's dumb. What does it mean, really? What do we say Zocher means? We say remember, it implies that maybe he forgets or forgets other things. Then that's dumb.
Based on the past.
Good for you. It's to Base a present action on a past fact. That's what Zocher means in Hebrew. Shrufus was from King Ahasuerus. So we just said that God bases his present actions on the history of the patriarch. Now it says that he brings a redeemer. Why? He brings a redeemer to their descendants because they are their descendants. They're the descendants of the patriarchs. Based on what he takes from their lives, that becomes the platform from which he brings the redeemer to their descendants. So that fits very nicely. You with me? Now, there are two qualifications made. And to understand this and its implications, I'm indebted to Rabbi Moshe Pinchas, one of my colleagues here at Rosamad. Laman Shemo, for the sake of his name, Yahavo, in love. Those two phrases give you different pictures. I would say contrasting pictures. For the sake of his name. For the sake of his name, pictures God infinitely high. He has a project. And he's working to make this project successful. He's there. Everything else is his project. And he's organizing it. Pursuing it. The next phrase is the Avo, with love. In love. Love means that he's committed to us. He's committed to us. He sees things from our point of view. He cares about us. He wants us to succeed. That's a different picture. That's not the picture of God in splendid isolation, in his infinite height, with his project, working on his project. No, it's involved, connected, committed, concerned. And the picture said that both are true. Both are true, and that in a way, the phraseology in the Shemona Esrei goes back and forth from these two different points of view. And if you're sensitive to the meanings of the phrases and how they portray the relationship, you can see that there's a kind of seesaw going back and forth. And that's important because we have to know that God relates to us in both of those ways and we relate to him in both of those ways. Okay. Then, I mentioned this last night, but those of you who weren't here, I'll just mention it again. Melech, the king who is Ozer, or Moshiach, or Magen. He helps, he saves, and he protects. I think this is a progression. I think all three are true. But all three are true variously. They're true for various parts of our lives. To help means I have to do it. It's my job to do it. But I don't have to do it alone. We do it together. To save means I can't do it. I'm on the point of drowning. And I can't handle it. So he does it. And mugging, shield, means I don't even get into trouble. The thing doesn't reach me. Doesn't interact with me. I don't have to do anything. I'm not even affected by it. The different aspects of our lives, the Kodesh Baruch Hu is Ozer, Moshiach, and Magen. And I think it would be worthwhile for a person from time to time to think about these things. Ozer, listen, there are mitzvahs that have to be done, mitzvahs that I'm capable of doing with difficulty, and I struggle with them, and I have to do them, but I realize that I can't do them alone, and I am receiving help. Then there are times, I don't know if this has happened to you, I guess it has, but if it hasn't, it definitely will, where there's a project, and you're responsible for it, and you come to a mabui satum. The walls close in on you, and there's just no way out. A number of times in my life where I just looked around, and you know, there was no way out. I said, I can't do it. I just can't do it. Look, you know, this is this. This is in front, back of me, they're chasing me. There's no way for me to go. If you want this to happen, you're going to have to do it. I can't do it. There's no way I can handle it. A number of occasions, you know, an unexpected thing opens up, and the door is open. And then you could meditate on the things which people suffer in this world of 6.5 billion people. The things that people suffer that you didn't even dream about. 40 or 50% of the world's population worries about getting enough food to eat. They worry about starving to death or dying of thirst. When's the last time you worried you might starve to death? Probably never. It just doesn't occur to you. And because you were born in the United States of America, you naturally speak the most important non-Hebrew language in the world. Half of the world's publications are in English. 3/4 of the world's scientific publications are in English. English is the richest language in the world. There's a bigger vocabulary, bigger expressive power than any other language in the world. The tool that you have for expressing yourself, understanding others, for defining the conditions of your life, in secular terms, is the richest tool that is known to man. Why is that so? Because English has just been the kind of scavenger. It's just picked up from everywhere. It's got Latin, and it's got Greek, and it's got French, and it's got Italian, it's got Spanish, it's got German, and it's got its own stuff, you know, just sort of picked up stuff from everywhere. The result of which is that it's an extremely rich language. You have a reasonably good education. Not nearly what you're capable of, but that's Americans, what do you expect? If you're English, you have a better education. And you should be thankful for it. You have monetary resources. And you've learned things which will enable you to make a decent living. The things that 96% of the world's population are suffering, you're spared. And then if you add on to it the benefits of a frum lifestyle. So, relative to other people, the divorce rate is lower, and the drug rate is lower, and the alcohol rate is lower, and the violence rate is much lower, and literacy rate. 1/4 of American citizens are functionally illiterate. In factories, when you want to teach new procedures, they have picture books, because you can't expect the workers to read words. So they have to portray it in pictures. So you're talking about a gift of a quality of life for which you did nothing. You're born into it. And all these terrible, terrible problems that people face don't even affect you. They don't even relate to you. So that's Mogen. That's Kadosh Baruch Hu protects you from all these things. That's those words. Are you with me? I suppose it's not too difficult. Good. Now, it ends. Blessed are Hashem, Mogen Abraham. Blessed are you, Hashem. The shield of Abraham. Now, this blessing didn't really show any favoritism to Abraham over Isaac and Jacob. All three are there. The Avos are mentioned in the plural, the patriarchs. The qualities, they have all three qualities. Why is the closing only Abraham? Okay, Mogen Abraham is a verse. Shield of Abraham. But there are verses for the other two as well. Tachan Yitzchak, Aver Yaakov. You could very easily have done that. Yeah.
If Abraham is a person which is a source of everything,
Very good. Number one, Abraham is Chesed, and Chesed is the source of all of the other principles. So by citing him, you've got the foundation of the whole thing. Quite right. Quite right. That's one reason why it definitely is appropriate. Yeah.
Weren't we saying before also that it's because of our forefathers' actions, so Abraham was the first one. And you talked about that part of their, now obviously they're great in their own right, but part of their shielding was from the merit of their father and grandfather, respectively.
Yeah, but you wouldn't use the word shield. You wouldn't use the word shield for them. Each one had his own phrase. You'd use a different phrase for each one. You're right. It would not be appropriate to say Mogen Abraham is for the Yaakov, because the word Mogen is only used for Abraham. But you could have said Mogen Abraham Upachat Yitzchak Ve'Avir Yaakov. You could have taken phrases from their lives and spelled it out that way. The Gemara uses the following phrase. It says B'cho Mitzayimim. With you, Abraham, we come to the end. We complete. So of course you could say B'cho Mitzayimim means the blessing, which is quite true. But there are those who want to understand it with a wider implication. B'chom Simon, with you, Abraham, we come to the end. We come to the end of time. We come to the end of this stage of history. Each stage of history had a focus, of our work to try to bring God into the world. Of course, there's 613 commandments, no question about it. And we're responsible, thus we can't do all of them. But there's also how we do them, how we implement them. And many sources say that at the end, the quality of performance of all the mitzvos is chesed. Loving kindness becomes the adverb that accompanies all the verbs. So, learning Torah. Learning Torah is as old as Torah exists, all the way back to even before the Torah was given. But now, when you sit in yeshiva, and you're learning Torah, it's very important to be concerned about what the other person's learning, and helping him, and making sure that he's doing okay. Because learning Torah has to be done with chesed. It has to be done with loving kindness. Because the Chom assignment, because Abraham is the quality of how we complete history. The davening. A person should be aware of the impact of his davening on the people around him. Good and bad. There are guys who get so wrapped up in their davening that don't appreciate the fact that other people also want to pay attention to what they're doing, and they're disturbing them. On the other hand, a person who shows some enthusiasm can inspire the enthusiasm in other people. Yes, davening is no longer a single, individual, enclosed performance, internal performance. No, b'chom asayim, we have to have Abraham's eyes to look at what we're doing. Every mitzvah should be done with that quality. It's a Hasidic teaching, but not only Hasidic. So the idea of Magen Avraham would be for us a symbol of how we have to approach all the mitzvahs that we do. Okay? Now, I'm going to just make a remark, an introduction to the next blessing. We said yesterday that the first blessing, talk about Gomel Chasadim Tovim, good loving kindnesses. Let's see if anyone remembers that. What did I say about good loving kindnesses? Why isn't that redundant? It's loving kindness. It's automatically good, isn't it? The answer was? No. There could be bad loving kindness. There could be such a thing. Why? Because everything is for the purpose of loving kindness. And there is evil in the world. That evil is for the sake of loving kindness that will come out of it. So, you could have such things. Now, think three phrases from the second blessing. Somech nofli. God supports those who fall. Rofei Cholim, He heals those who are sick. Matir Asurim, He frees those who are captives. Isn't that chesed? To support people who are falling? To heal people who are sick? Isn't that chesed? Why would that be in the second blessing and not in the first blessing?
Maybe it would.
Sorry? That's a logical thought, but I want to be more direct. In order to support people who are falling, there have to be
people trying to knock you over.
Before you get to that, people who are falling. In order to heal people who are sick, there have to be people who are sick. This picture is a picture of people who are suffering, but God repairs the suffering. Doesn't prevent the suffering, repairs it. So this is a picture of evil, but evil which is going to lead to good. Why are people sick? So that God can heal them. Why are people falling? So that God can support them. The ultimate goal is support, healing, freedom. That's the goal. But for some people, in order for them to fulfill their spiritual potential, they have to get to the goal through suffering. That's why it's in the second blessing. Second blessing, the subject is Gevura, strict justice, which can involve evil. And that's why even though God's activity is an activity of chesed, that's because all evil is for the sake of chesed anyhow. That's not shocking. But it's chesed in the context of suffering, not chasodim tovim. Good, loving kind, this is what you had in the first blessing. Okay? We'll go into detail tomorrow.